Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Chris Jackson.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Hey, Chris. You mentioned the other day about this. Well, if you have a problem, just change the terminology of it. And I thought that was an interesting take on things of possibly reframing an issue so you see it a different way or seeing a problem a different way. But I get the impression that wasn't what you were after with this comment.
No. And it came from a quick soundbite or a quick little video message from one of our many management gurus that have now infested LinkedIn and other places. And I might be
infested. That's a good term.
I might be being a bit flippant here because there's a lot of good messaging behind what they're trying to say. And I think what they do really well, of the good ones at least, is simplify what is common sense or well-known reality of life into meaningful chunks. It's really easy to get through into our brain. Now, our brain can be very good at blocking out or filtering out things we don't want to take seriously. Actually, when I was a kid, I remember my father was a school teacher, and in a city called Brisbane in Australia, there was in his teaching department, there was a lot of controversy about where they were going to build this new resource centre for teachers in the greater Brisbane area. They wanted it to be located in a fairly central location, not too far north, not too far south, to eradicate any perceived bias to one group of teachers over the other. And they agreed that it's going to be at this place called Mount Cutha. People in Brisbane now know where Mount Cutha is. It's roughly in the middle. It's roughly, you know, it's not too far north. It's not too far south. It's just in the Goldilocks zone, I suppose. And it turns out all they did was they were never changing the location of where this resource facility was going to be built. It's going to be built in a place called Mitchelton, which is very far north. But they just called it the Mount Cutha Resource Centre. It's just it's a few kilometres, nowhere near this place called Mount Cutha. They just called it the Mount Cutha Resource Centre or whatever it was. And that was, it's a good example of how just labels can mean absolutely nothing if there's not a fundamental change of the mindset that's supposed to accompany this new word we are now using vociferously or now not banned from using at all. And that teaching department example is a great example of how you can essentially get out of making challenging decisions or being a true leader in your organization, or make you feel like you're doing your job, just by authorizing or banning a word. And the word we're talking about in this podcast is failure, because I think one of our management luminaries was suggesting we should ban the word failure. Failure has such a negative connotation, and his point's valid, that we need to risk to create stuff. We can't just, if you stay in your comfort zone, you never grow. If you're trying to develop a new product, you need to, within reason, try stuff and learn from your mistakes after you've thought it through. Obviously, we don't want to just rush in and make mistake after mistake after mistake, but failure has a very important part in evolving and developing new things. But his point was that some companies or organizations try and discourage failure, and that has a follow-on effect of driving down or eradicating good risk-based decision-making.
Well, yeah, if you don't understand what the risks are, what are the potential failure mechanisms, or how is it failing in your prototypes, you make a really uninformed decision to launch the product, and then it fails all over the place with your customers. I think I said it in the last episode, is that failure mechanisms don't read the textbook. They're not reading a script. They're just doing what they do. It's the force of nature to some extent. But the basic idea of some organizations, don't tell me about failures, tell me about successes, tell me how it's going to work. And that's, you know, and you and I and others in the on this podcast have talked about that you need to celebrate failures. That's where you actually mm-hmm. learn something. I mean, we do HALT testing not to pass it with no failures. You do it to find failures. But just changing the term, let's call it something else. I remember way back in the day when I was at Hewlett-Packard, we didn't have problems, you know, field problems or field things like that. We called them issues, or more often we called them opportunities. And so it was kind of a positive spin on some issue or things, not ignoring it, but just rephrasing it into something more palatable. And I asked one of the marketing guys once about it, and he goes, well, we don't talk about failures with customers. They want a solution that solves a problem for them and creates productivity for them and does something like that. And so we don't advertise that our products will fail if you drop it out of a 10-story building. It's just not, it's not what they want to hear.
Yeah.
But if your application is dropping computers out of the 10th story window, you probably need to understand that it's not going to survive.
Yeah. And I would suggest a lot of customers who might not, who might bristle at the term failure in that scenario, the marketing conversation, we all innately know that things aren't perfect, things are going to break. And I know that, you know, if I'm looking at a technological third party, or information technology third party supplier or vendor, I'm actually more interested in how their service is. You know, if something bad happens, how long is it going to take before they rectify it? How many people are going to swing into action to make my issue go away? And so I know a lot of marketing teams tend to focus on that and say, look, you know, if you do have an issue, this is what we'll bring to bear to resolve that issue. And that sort of moves away from the concept of failure or the term failure into a space which is more positive, which is more about rectification, because we all sort of know things aren't perfect. But I suppose going back to my Mount Cutha example is a rose by any other name will still smell. That's a really useful saying, because mm-hmm. you can change the name of something, but if you don't change what it represents, or if you still don't resource your reliability engineering team, it just can have really perverse effects. So if you're not allowed to use the term failure, well, and there's no adequate replacement for that term, and it's just eradicated from jargon, without any resources or any additional laboratories to help you explore or identify issues earlier before they get in the hands of your customer, well, then it just turns into a joke. Your employees all make up their own lexicon, which mock you, the leader, who've just banned the use of this word. We know that, for example, we shouldn't be using racist words, but just banning a racist word doesn't make someone who's inherently racist cease to be racist. It's right. Still, it's a good thing in its own right, but it still doesn't solve some problems.
Doesn't solve the underlying problem. And what I've seen in a couple of organizations is that we only test to success. We don't like having failures. We don't want failures in our testing, because then our customers will recognize that our product can have failures. And so they design tests that are nearly guaranteed to pass with no failures whatsoever. So they can then trumpet that in front of their customers saying, look, our testing shows no failures. But it's so gerrymandered, or it's probably not the right word. It's just such a benign test. Of course it's going to pass. But what the customer in those cases we're seeing is, oh, they did 500 hours in the chambers and it passed, so it must be good. Well, they swapped out brand new units every 5 hours just to make sure that the 500 hours would pass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, no, this is not useful.
That said, I do recall one client who approached me because they're trying to characterize the reliability of a new technology they were using in a medical device.
Mm-hmm.
And they were genuinely struggling to make it fail. So as in, it was fantastic. The regulator required certain test paradigms based on old technologies. And they were just saying, look, we have to take it so far outside of its operational use that the mechanism that's going to drive it failure is just not relevant anymore. So they're really struggling in making it fail, which is not what you're talking about.
Oh, no, it's the opposite problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a client like that. They made it was a liquid solar power system. And it was a mat, a portable mat you could roll up and fold and do all kinds of cool stuff with. It was kind of like it wasn't very thick at all. I'm thinking of like a sill mat is used in baking. It's a kind of a polymer. Not near as thick as a pencil. So it's, I'm thinking, but thicker than the pencil lead. So mm-hmm. use some relative reference there. And it would be like a good size sheet of paper, it'd cover the top of your desk. And so the idea was that you could unroll it and you could plug stuff in and it would generate electricity.
Right.
And they were marketing it or trying to sell it to the military. And the military came back and says, well, that's great. How does it fail? Which I thought was brilliant. Somebody finally asked, well, mm-hmm. How does it not work? And yep. he says, well, if you put a bullet through it or puncture it or drive, you know, your vehicle over it and crushes it, that will make it fail. Oh, okay, that's good. Well, how does the technology fail? Mm-hmm. This chemical process you're describing here that takes energy from the sun, generates electricity, and then reformulates itself back into its starting state. It was this closed loop system where you're adding energy, right, with sun. You spit off some electrons, or electricity, some potential, but then the chemical process then resolves back to its initial state with what they were, and I'm sitting in a room with like five PhD chemists going, now, I don't think I need to tell you guys about the second law of thermodynamics. You know, this isn't possible. And he says, well, we're adding energy into it. And I'm like, okay. And they said, the problem is that we need to prove that it does fail at some point. There's some, and so we tried all kinds of different things. We tried cold, hot, thermocycling, this, that, all the different ways we could impact this chemical reaction. And he says, there's got to be enough impurities in there that it'll degrade. And we couldn't find anything. And I said, what you need to do is put more impurities in it so that it will wear out in 10 years or 20 years or something like that. Otherwise, they're not going to buy it. And they ended up making a solid state one that only had 5-year life. It consumed it. It didn't have enough mobility to do the second round of chemical processes to get back into state. So they put in a fixed amount of reactants so that as it hit sun, it would create electricity, but it would be consumed. And they could sell that, which I thought was ridiculous, but it was actually a good question. Well, how does it fail? Mm-hmm. But I think those two examples, yours and mine, Chris, are the exception. Most people don't want to know how it fails. And so what's the lifetime on this? Oh, it's 5 years. But no probability associated with it. Oh, it's 5 years. And so the customer is going to maybe assume it's good for 5 years without failure. And the producer is saying, well, 2/3 will fail in 5 years, so don't worry about it. But it's still 5 years.
That's right. It's comes back to the word failure again. I mean, it's, what does failure mean? And you're showing, again, what we're looking at here is always two competing parties. You've got the leadership team who say you can't use this word, and the employees who are the doers who go, okay, well, is there anything behind that? Yes or no? And you have the customer in one case saying, hey, how does it fail? We know things fail, but to be able to tell us how it fails, and the supplier going, well, in this rare case, we need to make up failures. It's just, again, it's just interesting how words can come back to bite us, you know, in ways that.
Well, the toxic culture where you're just not allowed to have failures, you're going to get what you design your system to do. Is we'll create tests, if we do have a failure, it was just a prototype. Oh, there was a fixture problem. Yeah. Oh, there was something. We can wave away opportunities that we really could learn something from, and we just ignore them. I'm pretty sure this one of my bosses one time was being facetious, making me go do my homework some more, but I brought up some test results and he said, well, that's not the answer I was looking for. Go try again. Okay. this isn't, that's not how it works. you know, here's, did I do anything wrong with the science of this or the measurement system or anything? No, no, no. It's just not my the answer I want. Go, you know, go measure some more. And I came back with more evidence that he was wrong. And he was finally accepted that. But you're right. You can't just change the term because it can have that dramatic negative consequence on how efficient your organization is at creating a product that meets customer expectations. I think that's a long way of saying you got to pay attention to failures right from the start.
That said, a word, you know, I've seen plenty of good leadership initiatives where they say, hey, we're going to drop using this word. We're going to start using this word or this phrase or call something this now, because I want to reinforce to each and every one of you that this is an opportunity, like you talked about, or a chance to improve. But that message doesn't stop at the end of this conversation. We as a leadership team are going to come around and reinforce this. We're going to be part of this. We're going to encourage people to do this. We're going to, you know, resource people to do that. It's not just a throwaway conversation in an auditorium where you take notes and say, huzzah, and go off and just do what you've always done. And then I get angry at you later on when the changes I was hoping for don't materialize. No, this is going to be something which is going to represent a new way of doing business. And using this new word symbolizes that. That's powerful. But if it's just changing words and nothing else, then it's just a joke. It becomes a running punchline for you as a leadership team.
Well, you see that in some organizations where they have their vision, you know, a plaque on the wall in all their conference rooms, and I look at it and goes, so does anybody actually do any of this stuff? You know, what is, you know, XYZ, they say on these vision statements, what does that mean to you guys? What? We don't do any of that.
Safety is our number one priority when, which in some organizations it is, they live and breathe it. Whereas other organizations just say, well, I get why safety is important, but is safety your number one priority? What does that mean to your day-to-day decision-making?
That's right. Now, I worked with one organization in the oil industry. And when I got to the site, it was the first time I visited anybody in the oil industry and in this particular organization. And it was worldwide. They were all over the place. I ended up spending time with them all over the place. And what struck me was when I got to the parking lot, all of the cars, every car, was backed into the parking spot. Now, if you pulled into a parking lot and they were all backed into the parking lot, would you notice that? I mean, maybe I'm just odd.
No, I'd notice that.
Yeah. I mean, it's different. It's not common in my experience anyway. So, and at lunch, I was talking to my, you know, host, the guy I was working with, and he says, you know, I don't want to, is there some rule that you, and because there were signs saying back into a parking spot. And so I did. And he goes, no, that's part of our safety regime. The organization found that auto accidents were a leading cause of injury and lost productivity in the organization. And so that organization hired a bunch of driving safety type people. And one of the things that happens is people, if you nose into a parking spot, that means you have to back out. And you have very limited visibility when you back out. And that has led to fender benders and injuries and accidents and stuff like that. And so there's evidence that proves that if you back into the parking spot, you're much less likely to have a problem because you can see the whole parking spot. It's very brief time when it's exposed, but when you back out, you're much more exposed and lot less visibility. So anyway, they said, so the corporation said, thou shalt back into parking spots everywhere, all the time. That's just a rule now. And they noticed the downtick in accidents, in lost productivity time, people taking time off to get their car repaired, stuff like that. And went on and on and on. They had, I don't know, dozens of different things. They had driver safety training for people. If you were going to rent a car, you had to go through this course on driver safety. And he goes, and people were signing up for it left and right because it made you a much better driver. And he said, just driving for my family, I learned so much that I feel so much more confident and safe with just driving my family around. So that's a company that took safety very seriously and moved it off of just putting handrails up in a few places.
But that's where they worked out the root cause of how things were failing at their organization, not what an auditor, an ISO 1 million auditor would say, oh, you need bigger signs over here. And this is aubergine. It's not midnight gray.
Aubergine's a color. Yeah. So, right. I mean, but back to the point is, I think you made a valid point. Is that it's if it's just a slogan, and Deming said that, if it's just a slogan on the wall, you're wasting your time. You know, and changing the terminology of what we do stuff, if it's not backed up and reinforced and part of the culture, it's just meaningless. We do run into many people that would rather talk about opportunities or ways to make improvement or better understanding or something like that, rather than saying, hey, I got 10 failures you got to deal with. Failure in and of itself does have a negative connotation across our society. So sometimes we need to watch how we bring problems up or failures up. But it's really reading the organization and changing the nature around it, so that when there is a problem with a failure of a prototype, if it's treated as an opportunity to actually learn something and make a better product, it's a completely different environment. It may or may not call it failure than one that just wants to ignore it, because we just don't tolerate failures. And that's the subtle difference. And our terminology obviously matters.
Yeah, the whole idea of failure is not an option. Very emotive statement. At the time, it made sense.
Yep.
But again, it really comes down to, we say this term a lot, culture. We also say leadership. We also say management. You can, if the change in vernacular actually reflects some new initiative, which is going to have a benefit, then that's fantastic. But if it becomes just a token of effort, replacing effort itself, then it's just going to introduce a level of humor, I suppose,
or frustration. Yeah, the worst would be frustration. But yeah, if you're listening to this, how do you talk about failures? You know, prototype failures or field failures, stuff like that. And some go to great lengths to change that terminology for good or for ill. How's it working in your organization? What do you call field failures, for example? Let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can find a SpeakPipe widget. You can leave us a voicemail, which would be great, because we'd love to include you as part of a future part of the conversation in a future episode. Or there's a form there you can type something in. Chris and I and the other hosts of the show are available through LinkedIn and through our About pages. There's contact information there. But the bottom line is, I don't care what you call it, we'd love to hear from you or read from you or whatever the right term is. Now you got me all bamboozled about what I should call stuff here, Chris.
Yeah, it's the last word on that then. But it's all about what you're trying to achieve.
All right. Well, thanks much, Chris. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.